Well, did anybody else find this chapter, the second discussion of how to read epistles, a difficult chapter to read, keep track of what they were saying? Carol shaking her head, yes. I seem to be getting some pretty general agreement on this one. This is a difficult kind of concept. When we start thinking about how do we form some guidelines that we can use to help us figure out whether what we read is something that we need to bring into our lives here in the 21st century in the United States. And at the outset, I want to say that the internet and the ability to communicate across cultures is a really good thing in some ways. And in some ways, it makes Bible study a little bit more difficult. We have to be aware that what exists in 21st century America is not what exists in 21st century India. They're dealing with different issues and different questions. And many years ago, we never really had to think about that too much, because what we said and what we did tended to be restricted to the place where we live. But now people comment on passages and they say things like, well, nobody in the world ever has to deal with eating meat that's been sacrificed to idols, because we don't deal with that here in the United States. But in some parts of the world, those are things that people are still dealing with. And their culture and our culture, because they're so vastly different, present different issues as far as trying to understand what the Bible says and whether we need to bring it into 21st century life. So keep that in mind as we go through this discussion tonight. The internet has made it possible for us to communicate so easily across cultures, and we have to remember that always when we post something on the internet. So we're going to talk a little bit about this notion of extended application. In other words, what I read in a passage, should that be something that I bring into my life? Is it something that really impacts me? Is it the specific statement that impacts me? Or is it the principle that seems to be behind the specific statement? And I want to mention one more caveat. There are a lot of times that when we read the Bible and we think about the information that it's giving us, we conclude that we ought to be doing something when we read a particular passage that really isn't in that passage. But it's true because we find it in a lot of other places. And we need to be very careful about that kind of thing. That's one of the things in my experience that really tends to turn people off about Bible study. So let's just be careful about that kind of thing when it comes to extending application. So when we extend application, we have two distinct situations. Sometimes what was going on in the first century in terms of the particulars, in terms of the specifics in a given situation, are the same as the specifics that happen in our culture today. And so we share these particulars, we share the specifics, and in that case, there's really no question. What God said to them is exactly the same thing that he's saying to us. And we need to think about it in that way. And we could multiply a lot of examples of this, but we're just trying to come up with a guideline that we can always use. So when we read the epistles, our first question is, okay, here's the specific thing that they were dealing with. This is the specific particular situation that they were in. Are we in the same specific particular situation today? And if we are, that's really pretty easy. Then we know that we ought to bring what they were told into our lives, and we're told exactly the same thing. We really don't need to work with that very much. That's pretty straightforward. But when you don't have the same particular situation, then it becomes a little bit more difficult. And you can't just say, well, God said to them, do this, so I need to do this because my situation is different. And Stuart and Fee talk about a principle that they call the stumbling block principle. And I just want to stop and talk about the stumbling block principle for just a minute. I had a good friend, Floyd Thompson. He's a lot older than I am. He was a very wise man. But he had a statement about the stumbling block, putting a stumbling block in front of somebody. He said there's a big difference between causing somebody to offend and giving somebody offense, or offending a brother. I don't think that we need to be so worried about offending people. We need to be concerned about doing things that cause people to sin. And I was watching this really interesting TV show last night. It's called What Would You Do? I don't know if you ever watched that, but they post these scenarios, situations, and they're made up. They have actors that are playing the parts, and then other people get to observe what's going on. Well, anyway, they had two actors, and one of the actors was saying, well, you know, I've given up alcohol. I don't drink alcohol anymore. And his wife was saying, yeah, but you're no fun. And she was trying to shame him into drinking alcohol. And the thing was, they were listening to what this was being overheard by some other people in that setting. And they wanted to see what people would do, whether they would come to this guy's defense and kind of tell his wife to back off a little bit, or what was going on there. And I just say that because it's possible for us to encourage people to do something that they believe to be sin. Whether we think it's sin or not, we encourage them to do that. And that happens a lot with cultures that are very different than ours. Remember, that's why I pointed that out at the beginning. In some places in the world, there is still a marketplace where they sell meat that has been sacrificed to idols, and it's clear that it's meat that's been sacrificed to idols. And it would be inappropriate for us, 21st century Americans, where we don't have that as a part of our culture, to try to impose 21st century American values and say, well, you can eat that meat, it doesn't matter. Everybody knows that the idol is nothing. Well, in their culture, not everybody knows that. So we have to be very careful about the stumbling block principle. And remember, we're causing people to sin when we do this. This is a serious issue. It's not just that they don't like it. We're causing them to sin because we're encouraging them to do something that they believe God told them not to do. So we don't ever want to do that. The fact that the particular activity that they're engaging in may not be sin, but they believe it is, and the sin is, they just don't care. We're telling them you don't have to pay attention to what God said. That's sin when we do that. Okay. Questions about where we are at this point? I've tried to illustrate that stumbling block principle, talking about moving to California from Kentucky, back in 1966. In 1966, I moved to California, and in California, the law says when you pull up to a stoplight, if the stoplight is red and there's no traffic coming, you can go ahead and turn right. Now, we're familiar with that. We know that that's the law here. But I grew up in Kentucky. And in Kentucky, in 1966, when you pulled up to a stoplight and it was red, you stayed stopped. They didn't have the law in Kentucky like they did in California that said you could stop, make sure the traffic is clear, and then you could turn, go ahead and turn right. And so I got to California. I'm a kid, and I thought, this is cool. You don't have to pay attention to the law in California. Now, if I had pulled up to that stoplight and gone ahead and turned right, I would not have violated the law. But I still would have been in trouble because I thought I was violating the law. And my problem was I decided to do something regardless of what the law said. That's the sin I was involved in. Not turning right on a red light. And it's the same with eating meat. It's not sinful to eat meat sacrificed to idols. Paul explained that in 1 Corinthians. But not everybody knows that. So let's just always keep that in mind. So that's the first situation. You got the same particulars. If you have the same particulars, then you take what it says and you bring it right over. What do you do when our particular specific circumstance is not comparable to what they were dealing with? Well, there are two things that need to be said here. Sometimes the particular circumstance is so different that you don't bring over the instructions, the specific instructions, but you do look for the principle that's behind it. And you can still apply the principle. So we're not bringing the specific information over. We're saying here's the principle that we need to be concerned about. And when we're talking about principles and extending principles, that's where it gets a little dicey sometimes. sometimes we see the same principle discussed in a different specific situation. And what that tells me is, hey, the principle is what's important, not the specifics. You see what I'm saying? If you go back to the same principle, even though the specific situation changed, that tells me, hey, it's that principle that you need to be concerned about, not the specific instructions. And when that's the case, it's really easy to say, let's be concerned about the principle. If it's the principle that's involved, and there are other passages that deal with different specific situations that give different instructions to deal with those specific situations, you'll never find the specifics in the sin list. What you will find is the principle in the sin list. And we're familiar with those passages where one of the apostles, one of the writers, will define a long list of sins. But they tend to be things that are always wrong in every culture, in every time. Malice is always wrong in every culture at every time. Now, the way that it's expressed might look different in one culture or from one culture to another, but malice is a problem. Okay? For a woman to respect the chain of authority that's laid out in 1 Corinthians 7 is always important. The head of the woman is the man, the head of the man is Christ, and the head of Christ is God. No question. There's principle. Okay? In specifics, is it wrong for a woman who gets married to decide to keep her maiden name? Well, no, you can still respect the principle, and she might decide not to change her name. Now, many years ago in America, we wouldn't have asked that question because women that got married always changed their name to their husband's name. That's not the case anymore. Do women wear wedding bands in America? Well, yes. Is that it's a specific, but the specific is not what's important. What's important is the principle behind it, recognizing the God's chain of authority. Men wear wedding bands. Some do, some don't. Some can't. If you work around heavy machinery, you're forbidden to wear a wedding ring in a lot of settings, because if you snag that ring with a fly cutter on a milling machine, it not only takes the wedding ring off, it takes your finger off. If you're in the Navy on board a ship, you can't even wear a belt. And it's the same reason. If you hook the belt in one of those big pieces of equipment, it's going to pull you in and you're done. So for that reason, Navy work uniforms, because they're working around heavy machinery all the time, don't have belts. They always have buttons. I found that really strange when I first met guys that were in the Navy, that they always had buttons on their uniforms, no belts. So understand the difference between the specific instruction and the principle that's behind it. Is that clear as mud, or did that help to maybe make some sense out of some of the things that Stuart and Fee were saying? Maybe it's just less muddy. I'll settle for less muddy. Okay. Now we have to think about things that are written in the epistles that are culturally determined. And remember, always remember, the epistles were letters that were written in the first century. They were written in that language from the first century, and they were written presuming that culture. And they spoke to specific situations in the life of either first century churches or first century Christians. You know, some letters were written to individuals, some were written to churches. And even those that were written to churches sometimes dealt with the life of specific individuals. And there are certain situations in the epistles, and we have to be aware of it, that are so completely conditioned by first century settings that the only way that they have any meaning for us is they illustrate a specific related to a general principle. So the Apostle Paul told Timothy to bring him the cloak that he had left at Crispus's house, and the principle is help people out. Today, we would probably just, we would put it in the mail. But that doesn't mean if we put it in the mail that we haven't fulfilled the specifics. So, then there are other passages, other parts of the epistle that are first century specifics, but we can translate that because we have something that's kind of the same. Greet one another with a holy kiss, okay? If I was writing that today in 21st century America, and we're dealing with the pandemic, I would say, greet one another with a holy elbow bump. I used to say, if I was writing that to 21st century Christians, greet one another with a holy handshake. But we don't handshake anymore. Now it's a holy elbow bump. And that doesn't mean that we're not doing what the epistles are telling us was important. And then there are some passages that I really struggle to even find a principle that's involved here. And so I can't bring the specifics over, and I have trouble figuring out what the principle might be. I mean, we all know in the first century, fathers arranged for their children's marriages. There was no dating to figure out who you were going to marry. Your father arranged it if you were a woman. Okay? If you were under the age of 30, you could not sign a contract if you were a woman. Your husband or your father could disallow it. And I can't find anything, I can't find any way to bring that kind of information into the 21st century. So we just have to accept that there were some things that happened then that don't happen now. So let's see if we can come up with some general guidelines. I think it's always important for us to keep in mind the core message of the Bible. Jesus came here to save us from our sins and to teach us how we were supposed to live after he had saved us from our sins. That's the core message. I'm not saying that other things aren't important. I'm just saying that's the core message. So always go back to that. That's what's really, that's why we're reading the Bible. We want to find out how to deal with our sin problem, and we want to find out how we're supposed to live. So everything else is secondary. And I don't mean to say that there are some passages that are important and others that aren't. It's just we always have to remember to keep that always before us. I think it's important that we distinguish between activities that are inherently moral, truth-telling, for instance, and cultural expressions of morality. And you get into, thinking about should a Christian take the oath with his hand on a Bible when he testifies in court? And some people have come down on both sides of that, and you try to figure that out. But the Christian can't lie. So that's an inherently moral decision. A Christian can't lie. Now, that doesn't mean that the Christian has to answer every question that somebody asks him. If let's just suppose that we were living in a situation where the government wanted to take my children away from me, and the government arrested me and asked me a question, where are your children? I can't lie, but I don't have to answer that question. I'm not going to tell them I don't know, because I probably know. I'm not going to tell them that they're somewhere where they're not. I'm just going to say I'm not going to answer that question. So just remember to distinguish between inherently moral things and cultural expressions of morality. Third guideline. Look for cases of uniformity and cases of consistency, as opposed to cases where people that were facing apparently the same situation were given different information. And I think about circumcision. Paul took Timothy and had it circumcised. He refused to circumcise Titus. So you have to struggle to figure out what it was that was uniform about those situations, because clearly there was some difference. And we have to understand that. And we have to distinguish between principles and specific applications. Okay. Number five. We need to distinguish those cases where the New Testament writers were constrained by cultural options and the specifics don't really quite appear to deal with what we're dealing with today. And I think about the issue of slavery. You know, if you were the Apostle Paul writing about slavery to Philemon, you're constrained by the available options. So Paul wrote to Philemon. He did not tell Philemon, you must release this man because it's immoral for one man to own another. He did not tell him that. In fact, he accepted the fact that there were slaves. Now, that doesn't mean he supported slavery, but that was the only option that was open to them at that time. That makes sense? We also have to understand the limitations of first century culture. Nowhere in any part of the Bible will you see a discussion of participatory democracy. Now, why is that? That was unknown in the first century. They never discussed that. So you have a limitation that comes from first century culture. That doesn't mean we can't take some principles and we can think about how those principles might impact participatory democracy. But the fact that they never talked about participatory democracy doesn't mean that that kind of governmental system is somehow immoral, or that it shouldn't exist. There is no reason to conclude that. That was always a little bit difficult for me. Knowing that there were some things that exist today that did not exist in the first century. How do we use the internet? That's a big one. And we're going to struggle with that. We're going to try to figure that out. Is it reasonable for people to say, I will gather with the church on the first day of the week to celebrate the Lord's Supper, and I will choose to do that via Zoom? That option was never available in the first century. They couldn't have even imagined that that option was available. So we have the principle that says, forsake not the assembling of yourselves together. Are we doing that now? Are we assembling ourselves together? So could people decide, well, that's the way I'm going to assemble in the future, even though Carver Road is meeting in their building. I'm just going to do it via Zoom. And we're going to have to come to grips with some of those things. We're going to have to learn to understand those issues. And then above all, I think maybe the most important guideline is exercise charity. Not everybody's going to understand everything in exactly the same way. And there doesn't have to be one right and one wrong way to do it. There can be two right ways to approach it. So, exercise charity. And I suppose that's why that's so foremost in my mind when we talk about our response to coronavirus and meeting in the building and letting people or encouraging people to participate via Zoom. We have to exercise charity. Last issue, last thing I want to discuss is the difference between task theology and systematic theology. And I'll just tell you, I find it a really thorny task to make sure that if I put something from 1 Timothy together with something from Titus, that Paul would have put it together. So just stringing a lot of statements together is not something that I do very often. And you probably noticed that about my preaching. I tend not to do that kind of thing. I tend to want to take a statement and analyze that statement. Now, that's not to say that we can't form some kind of an understanding of an overall theology by taking all of the statements that I find anywhere in the New Testament that apply to a given situation and try to formulate something that's applicable in the overall. That's often a good exercise, but I worry that we aren't careful enough about how we go about doing that. You know, could Timothy appoint elders based on the list of qualifications that the Apostle Paul sent to Timothy? Absolutely. Could Titus appoint elders based on the list of qualifications that Paul sent to Titus? Absolutely. Are they exactly the same? Nope. Is it possible to say, when we appoint elders, let's combine the two lists? Now, that's the systematic approach. But remember, Timothy was fine with the information that Timothy had. And Titus was fine with the information that Titus had. So let's just be careful when we combine information from different letters and come up with a systematic approach. Okay, I'm done. I'm one of those teachers, you know, somebody said there are two kinds of teachers, those that have to say something and those that have something to say. I've run out of things that I have to say, so I'm not going to sit here and tell you that we have to fill up the hour. I'm open to suggestions or comments from other people, because I'm not the only one that has some kind of understanding about this.
Dean, how far did we get in the chapter, or are you finished covering the chapter?
Next week, we're going to talk about Old Testament narratives, like we're talking about it right now, the Old Testament narrative that you see in the Judges. And there's a lot of the Old Testament. We call it just history. And that's what it is. So we're going to talk about how do we take those Old Testament narratives and figure out what it's telling us. Because we encountered some people who did some at least questionable things, and we have to figure out how we're going to deal with some of those narratives. Boy, everybody's really quiet tonight.
Thank you, Dean, for putting that together.
Well, you're welcome. You're very kind. I hope it made it clear and didn't just muddy the water.
Dean?
Yes.
I have a question on page 86. I understand that somebody who's a woman could be an apostle because she's one who's sent, but I don't understand his interpretation of where Phoebe is a deacon. Romans 16, 1 and 2.
Right. Well, if you look at the word deacon, not used in the King James translation, but that word is applied to her in the original language. It just means servant. Now, not every servant was qualified, given the qualifications in 1 Timothy and Titus, in the same way that not everybody that was referred to as an apostle is an apostle in the sense of the original 12 plus one plus the apostle Paul. So she is called a servant of the church. Not in the same sense that you find it described in 1 Timothy. I think the men who were appointed to oversee the distribution of the Grecian widows in Acts 6 were servants of the church. They're called servants, and that's that word, deacon. But the fact that the same word is used doesn't mean that everybody would have had the same office. That's not even a the good way to say it. But not everybody that was a servant in Acts 6 necessarily met the qualifications that are laid out for deacons in 1 Timothy and Titus. They may have, but I don't know. The seems to me that the most important qualification in Acts 6 is that they were men who were filled with the Holy Spirit. So Phoebe is a servant, in the same sense that the men in Acts 6 were servants. We can name one, Stephen. I can't name all the others, the seven men that were appointed. But they were deacons. They were servants. Okay? So, I spend a lot of time when people say, well, you don't ever appoint women to be deacons. No, we have women servants in the church. And you can call them deacons if you want to. That's fine. Just understand that words change meanings and they get confused. So I tend to not use the word deacon to refer to women. I would refer to them as servants. They are, in fact, deacons.
Thank you, Dean.
Okay. Now they don't make, I do think that Stuart and Fee don't make that very clear, because I get the impression that one of the things that they want to accomplish is to say that we have demeaned the work of women in the church, and we shouldn't be doing that. And with that statement, I absolutely agree. There are women servants of the church today, just like there were women servants of the church in the first century. And because we don't give them a title and we don't put their name in the directory under the list of deacons, we say, well, you devalue the work that women do. Well, maybe that's true.
Isn't that what a widow indeed, when during that time period that she was, financial responsibility was taken on by the congregation, but then she basically was a servant and did things in the congregation to keep the congregation going.
Right. The only distinction would be that the word deacon is never used to refer to her. But I think in terms of distilling the principle out of that, you're absolutely right. I think that's what she was doing. She was a servant of the church. Okay. The unfortunate thing is that we tend to say that something like the word prophet, and that's another one of those things that becomes very confusing. Someone who is a prophet always did his work in the assembled group. And that's not the case. There were women prophets, and they prophesied. Now, they may not have done it in the assembled body, but to say that there were no women prophets would be to fly in the face of clear statements. So those words get abused, and we don't distinguish the meaning of words as clearly as we ought to. So we'll spend some time on Sunday morning. We're going to talk about kindness. And you might be surprised when we talk about the definition of kindness and what that means. So stay tuned. I've still got to work out how I'm going to talk about that, but it's a really interesting definition when you think about the word kindness. And it probably isn't what you would naturally assume in 21st century America if I asked you to define what it means to be kind. So we'll talk about that on Sunday.